often. Okay, so I'm going to give you an update on this now well-known phenomenon of the accelerating universe. And for those who are new to the field and graduate students and others who may not have heard many talks on it, I'll give a brief overview that's sort of in historical chronological order. But then I'll try, before too long, to get to the really new stuff. And the new stuff is that we've now detected the early era of deceleration in the universe. And we're also beginning to set pretty good constraints on this equation of state parameter for the universe, W, where P is W times rho c squared. We're finding, to give the punchline, that W is basically minus 1 to within about 10 or 15%, depending on your assumptions. And that's the W that one gets for the cosmological constant. And we have a first estimate for dWdz, or W prime, and it's consistent within 1 sigma with 0, which again is sort of the cosmological constant. Now, there are many, many thousands of quintessence models and other things out there, and we're hoping to use observations to rule some of them out. And I'm sure thousands will still remain, but as the that's not to say anything negative about theoretical physicists, okay? But you guys know darn well how you are. Clever theorists will come up with models even for incorrect observations. And so, okay. So just to get everyone on the same page, let me show this diagram. The next two diagrams, if you understand them, you'll understand the whole talk, okay, or at least how we're going about doing things. Here are different world models for the expansion of the universe. A dense universe expands for a while. My battery seemed to have gone dead. Expands for a while, then recollapses. An empty universe, of course, has no reason to decelerate. The critical density universe slows down to zero expansion at time equals infinity. And then, of course, this recent new twist of a possible universe that is now dominated by a dark energy with a negative pressure. So it's accelerating, and it's more negative than negative one-third of the energy density, so that rho plus 3p is negative, and negative of rho plus 3p is an acceleration. And so the dynamics of the universe are that it's accelerating in this kind of a situation, but was decelerating early on because the universe was dense and omega matter was greater and this dark energy had less overall influence. So this is a possibility. Whether you like it or not, it's a possibility, and in fact it is in fact the universe that we think we live in. So which kind of universe we live in will depend on our, well, to find out which kind of universe we live on, we can look at observations of objects at progressively higher redshifts. So redshift zero is right now when the scale factor of the universe is the current scale factor. Redshift zero, one is r of t naught over r of t naught. If you go to higher and higher redshifts, you're looking back in time. Redshift one half, for example, you're looking at the object as it was when the scale factor of the universe was one half of its present value, because by advanced mathematics that even people here will understand, 1 over 1 half is 2, and 1 plus 1 is 2, so it all works out. So let's go to a redshift of 1 or something like that and draw a horizontal line and ask ourselves what that means. At a given redshift, say of 1, this horizontal line intersects these world models in different cosmic times. So the look back time for a closed universe is the smallest. For a medium density universe, it's bigger. For a less dense universe, it's even bigger still. For an empty universe, bigger still. And for a currently accelerating universe, the look back time at a given redshift is even greater. And so all the curves here are normalized to have the same slope because that's just the current expansion rate of the universe. Whatever it is, it is. You might disagree about what that value is, but it is some value, and they all have to agree, and all the slopes are the same. But as you go to higher and higher redshifts, these curves start to diverge in terms of look-back time, and since distance is speed times time, some measure of the galaxy's distance, say the luminosity distance that I'll define in a minute, will differ as well. Okay? So the thing to do is to look at objects at progressively greater distances or progressively greater redshifts and see how their luminosity distance, which I'll define in a minute, depends on redshift. So at low redshifts, they all converge to the same line. That just says that the expansion rate of the universe is what it is right now. That's Hubble's law. But as you go to bigger redshifts, the curves begin to diverge. And as advertised, at a given redshift, the dense universe has the smallest lookback time or distance, and progressively less dense universes have bigger lookback times or bigger distances. And if you have a currently accelerating universe, you get an even bigger luminosity distance for a given redshift. All right? So that's what we're trying to find out, which of these curves our universe has been following. Now, the luminosity distance is just a distance defined such that the inverse square of law of light is exactly followed, all right? At high redshifts, you have to worry about which measure of distance you use. There's angular diameter distances, there's all sorts of kinds of distances, and as long as you stick with one and you're consistent, you'll get the right answer. You don't want to be mixing distances, and this is a conceptually easy one to use, and it's one which we measure. We measure fluxes of objects whose luminosities we know, and from that we can derive luminosity distances. And so that's what we observational astronomers who study supernovae tend to use. So just to reiterate, the luminosity distance is just that distance that satisfies the inverse square law of light. So we need some sort of a candle which is both luminous and visible at high redshifts where these curves begin to diverge, and one whose luminosity is either the same for all of them, truly standard, or calibratable in a well-defined way. And nothing is truly standard in astronomy. They all have some variability, right? Even Cepheid variables aren't all the same luminosity. There's a period luminosity relationship. So you never find a standard candle, but you might find a candle that's both luminous and calibratable. And one type of supernova, the type 1a supernova, is such a candle. It brightens over the course of a few weeks, fades over the course of a few months, and reaches a luminosity of about a billion solar luminosities. So these things can be seen at very, very large distances. The type 1As, yes? Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that was sped up with time, but that was real data. You know, I didn't want to bore you by having it brighten over the course of a few weeks and fade over months, but that is supernova 1998 BU, and they're named in order of discovery in any given year. And this is a little video based on real data, and there at its brightest, you can see that it's about as luminous as the central nuclear region of a galaxy, which might be about 1 billion solar luminosities. So, but those are real data, yeah. Okay, so what are the type 1As? Well, the type 1s are the supernovae that don't have hydrogen. They have lots of other stuff, but they don't have hydrogen. Type 2s do have hydrogen. The 1As are distinguished from 1Bs and Cs by various spectral characteristics that I won't bore you with right now. And in fact, it is thought that physically the type 1Bs and Cs are much more closely related to the type 2s. These are core collapse objects. They are massive stars whose cores collapse. And the type 1As are thought to be the thermonuclear runaway of a white dwarf. And observationally, they are indeed all quite similar. Here are spectra of three type 1As taken 1 week after maximum brightness. The spectrum changes with time, so you've got to be sure you're comparing type 1As at the same phase of their development. But here you can see the spectra look quite similar. This region here, you'll see that the details of these wiggles are all very similar. There are some differences. This line is a bit weaker in this object than it is in that one. You can see quite a few subtle differences in this region of the spectrum. So we're not saying they're all the same, but they are spectroscopically quite similar. And photometrically, they are observed to be rather similar. That is, if you measure a bunch of type 1As in galaxies of known distance, so we've used Cepheid variables or some other method to get their distance, you find that they all reach about the same peak luminosity with a dispersion of about 50%, okay, which is pretty good. You know, quasars have a dispersion of thousands and stuff, right? They're luminous, but they can't be used for this kind of cosmology. Brightest cluster galaxies are all over the map in terms of how luminous they are. And so it's hard to find objects that are both luminous and have a small dispersion. And type 1A supernovae have a reasonably small dispersion, okay, observed. Now, theoretically, we think we sort of understand that because the best Bayh model, though it has not yet been proven, And this is the biggest embarrassment in the whole use of type 1As, is that we don't really know how they get to the explosive state. But nevertheless, we think that they are white dwarf stars, like what our sun will become in 6 or 7 billion years, with the difference being that they're bound to another star sufficiently close that mass transfer can occur during some late evolutionary stage of this companion star. Matter swirls onto the white dwarf and builds up its mass. Now, there are lots of caveats here. In many cases, you get degenerate surface eruptions on the white dwarf, and that leads to what astronomers call a regular nova. And if that, if anything, blasts more material away than what was collected, and so the white dwarf actually loses mass. So somehow you have to avoid the nova phenomenon. And some of these guys apparently avoid blasting the surface regions away. They build up their mass up to the Chandrasekhar limit of around 1.4 solar masses, and then the whole thing goes off. And so at least semi-quantitatively, we understand why these things are all about the same, because they all go off at the Chandra limit. And maybe there are some metallicity dependences. In other words, these carbon-oxygen white dwarfs have a greater or smaller amount of contaminants from previous generations of star formation. That could affect the burning front, or maybe the age of the white dwarf and the temperature affects the burning front. There are things that can affect these white dwarf explosions in ways that are now being investigated by LARS and observational astronomers and others. And this is something that we still don't completely understand, but at least we have some reason to think that these will be theoretically all about the same, with perhaps some dispersion. Okay? Now, you can test whether the luminosity of type 1As correlates with other observable parameters, like the age of the stellar population in which the white dwarf exploded. If it's surrounded by young stars, it's probably a pretty young star, and maybe those explosions have a different luminosity and shape of the light curve than the explosions that go off in ancient stellar populations like those in elliptical galaxies. You can test for such things by finding nearby supernovae. And you can test whether there are correlations between the peak luminosity and other observable parameters, such as the light curve shape. So to set this on a cosmologically strong footing, we have to observe a bunch of nearby type 1A supernovae, measure their peak luminosity, see whether it correlates with other things, and so on. And only then can we use these things for cosmology at large redshifts. So one of the things that our team has been doing is finding lots and lots of nearby supernovae to study them really, really well, okay, in galaxies of known distance and known metallicity and so on. And it's actually not that hard to find nearby supernovae. You take photographs of galaxies and you look for arrows, and where there are arrows, there are exploding stars. So worked once, twice, three times, four or five, twice even in the same galaxy. By mathematical induction, it must work every time, okay? So, well, it's not so easy, of course. We take photographs with a robotic telescope and a CCD camera attached to it, and my team has built this Katzmann automatic imaging telescope at Lick Observatory, just an hour's drive east of San Jose. And it's a small telescope by today's standards, only 3/4 of a meter in diameter, but it's completely robotically controlled. It goes and monitors about 1,200 bright nearby galaxies per night, taking CCD images of them and comparing them with software to previous images. And usually the new images look the same as the old images, but occasionally something new shows up. And here it's particularly obvious, and so the program makes a little arrow. All right. Other cases are not quite so obvious, and we have to use techniques, well-developed astronomical techniques of template subtraction. So here's a new image of this rather bizarre-looking galaxy, and here's the template image taken some time ago. And the sharp-eyed observer will see that there's a little protrusion sticking out right there. And when you subtract the template from the new image, you get this supernova candidate, as well as a cosmic ray in this case, and some poorly subtracted bright stars. Some of these stars don't subtract out perfectly because of variations in the shape of the mirror from night to night. So our software flags the supernova candidates, and comes up with maybe a couple of dozen per night out of 1,200 observed galaxies. And then I have a team of undergraduate students who use their superior brains and eyes to determine which of these candidates are true supernovae. And here's about half of my team. Actually, this picture was taken about a year ago. She's now in grad school at UC Davis, and he's moving on to grad school at Minnesota. And there's maybe five more. There's about 10 undergrads at any given time, and they check these images. So here's our history of supernova discoveries. We finally got the telescope going in 1997, and we found our first supernova of questionable integrity, given its name, 1997 BS. But as I said, they're named in order of discovery from A through Z, AA to AZ, BA to BZ. So I will leave it as a relatively uninteresting exercise for the listener to figure out what number that one happened to be. Anyway, we then set a bunch of world records. Everything in red was a world record. In the year 2000, we were busy expanding our database of galaxies from 5,000 to 14,000. So we didn't quite get as many supernovae, but we had many, you know, big dividends in subsequent years. And I'm proud to say that we found the first supernova of the new millennium, regardless of your definition of the new millennium. You know, so we made a plot of how we were doing in early November of last year, and an extrapolation of this plot as of early November then predicted that we would find 95, and sure enough, we found 95. We really wanted to hit 100 just for kicks, you know. Anyway, we've found 31 so far this year. But we also want to follow these supernovae. You know, we don't want to just find them. You could maximize the number of galaxies you observe if you want to maximize the number of supernovae you find. But if you want to find them early, and if you want to spend part of your time monitoring the supernovae, then you don't have as much telescope time for the search. But this is what's scientifically important. I mean, the finding them is just a numbers game. You know, world records, big deal. But getting good light curves and trying to understand something about the physics of the supernovae is what we really want to do. That's our motivation. So here are pretty typical light curves through blue, visual, red, and near-infrared bands taken with our telescope. And for the very brightest supernovae, we also do a near-ultraviolet band. And if you look at these light curves in detail, you notice a very interesting trend that was first quantified with some precision about a decade ago by Mark Phillips. And the technique was improved by Adam Riess and collaborators, and by Mario Amui and his collaborators. So there's this very interesting trend. Not all supernovae have the same peak luminosity. Fine. But those that are more luminous tend to rise and decline more slowly than those that are less luminous. So there's a light curve shape versus luminosity correlation. Yeah, and well, yeah, that's right. We had that discussion over lunch, yeah. We won't mention which kind of theoretical physicist we were talking about, but there's a luminosity light curve shape correlation. So if you've calibrated that using a few dozen galaxies in supernovae in galaxies of known distance, then you can use this correlation to effectively figure out what the luminosity is of a supernova of unknown distance. So instead of saying that, well, that's a 100-watt light bulb with an uncertainty of 50 watts, you can say, aha, that one is a slow riser and a slow decliner, so that guy is a 120-watt light bulb with an uncertainty of only 15 or 20 or 12 watts or something like that. So you can greatly decrease the dispersion, and you can assign a luminosity out of this distribution of supernova luminosities by measuring the light curve shape. The slow ones are the bright ones, the fast ones are the intrinsically faint ones. Moreover, by doing these measurements through different filters, you can measure the color of the supernova, and that tells you through how much dust and gas the light of the supernova has passed, because just like the setting sun looks red, normal interstellar dust reddens the sunlight, the starlight, and the supernova light. And so by measuring the color of the supernova, you can figure out whether it's dim in part because the light has passed through dust rather than because the thing is distant. So we use this multicolor light curve shape method on a nearby sample of supernovae, and here's what we get. The top diagram again is proportional to log of the luminosity distance versus log of redshift or recession velocity. And here you don't take into account the intrinsic dispersion of the type 1As, and you don't take into account the fact that their light has passed through different amounts of dust. So there's a Hubble log, right? The universe is expanding. But there are a lot of points that are way off the relation by many, many sigma. And this one, for example, looks way too distant given its recession velocity. It should be down here somewhere. Well, we now understand that that one looks way too distant because it's dim, but that's because its light has passed through a dense screen of dust. All right? One of these is similarly distant because of dust, or distant looking. The other one looks too distant given its recession velocity because it's the subluminous variety of supernova. And when you turn the crank blindly, all right, using your calibration set of 24 supernovae of known distance and known light curve shape and known extinction, and you then apply this to this independent set of 50 supernovae, the dispersion decreases by a factor of 3 to about 15% in peak luminosity. And so the utility of every supernova improves by about a factor of 9 because it goes as a square of the dispersion. Moreover, because we use all supernovae, we don't throw out ones we don't like or whatever, we're much less susceptible to various selection biases that might be nipping us in the butt or something if we were to throw out ones that we don't like, or if we were systematically missing the dim ones and only concentrating on the bright ones or whatever. We find all of them to some flux limit, which is deeper than the expected peak brightness of the supernova at large distance. And we put them all through this machinery, and we don't throw away ones we don't like. We might throw away ones for which the data are not very plentiful, or the night was bad or something, but we don't throw away ones that we don't like because they're off of the Hubble diagram. We don't play that game, okay? So it's this success at low redshifts that gives us some confidence in applying this technique at high redshifts, which is what I want to go to now. So as most of you probably know, in the past 10 years, there's been two main groups working on this: the Supernova Cosmology Project, led by Saul Perlmutter at the Lawrence Berkeley Lab, and the High Redshift Supernova Search Team, led by Brian Schmidt at the Australian National Observatory. And contrary to popular misconception, you know, we're not always fighting with each other. You know, we're not always duking it out. It has generally been a friendly and certainly a spirited competition, and it has made us all work faster and more carefully because we wanted to beat each other, okay? Well, we take the data with now these giant arrays of CCDs that cover the area of the full moon. These are truly gargantuan mosaics that exist now in the world's biggest telescopes. And here's 1/8 of this whole field. And then you zoom in on just a part of that. And you know, there's galaxies all over the place. And in these mosaics, there's, you know, 10,000 galaxies. And you take a bunch of mosaics per night. And then 3 weeks later, you come back and you image the same parts of the sky. And with statistics like one supernova per century per galaxy, you've got tens of thousands of galaxies, you'll always find a bunch of supernovae. So we find them in batch mode by subtracting the second epoch images from the first epoch images, and these supernova candidates come up. We get spectra to make sure that they're supernovae, to make sure they're type 1As, and to even look for possible evolutionary problems. This one at redshift 0.45 has a spectrum that, to within the noise, is essentially identical to a zero redshift supernova. That suggests, but does not prove, that there's no evolutionary correction to the luminosity. All right? We measure other things as well. How long does it take them to rise to maximum brilliance? We measure all possible observables and compare them at low redshift and high redshift. And if we get agreement, which we have so far, then it is a reasonable assumption that they have the same luminosity as well. But that is an assumption that has to be tested. Okay? As I said, we find these things in batches. Here's a batch from way back, 1996. We found 18 or so supernovae in just two nights of telescope time. A few of them were in the template images, and we ignore those because we didn't follow them. We then can plan on having follow-up time with the world's biggest telescopes, including HST, and we can get the follow-up photometry that we need to measure the light curves, measure the peak brightness, or have a reasonable interpolation based on a model light curve fit to the data. We can read off the peak here with very little uncertainty. And we can measure the shape of the light curve and make this correction for the luminosity differences. And we do it in several colors, V and B, and redder colors and near infrared, and that way we can make these extinction corrections as well. So we do exactly the same thing to the high redshift supernovae as we've done to the low redshift supernovae. Okay. By the way, cute little thing, the spectra have broader light curves by a factor of 1 plus redshift, and that's exactly what you expect in an expanding universe. So the redshift is not due to tired light and things like that. Okay, so moving on, because I want to get to the new stuff. Here's now the old results. These were the first data that were published in 1998 by our group and in 1999 by Perlmutter's group, although the announcement was made at the same meeting in LA in February of 98. And so again, here's log of luminosity distance versus log of redshift, effectively. And a universe which is Einstein de Sitter, so omega matter of 1, no dark energy, is this dashed line. And the data are well above that. In this differential Hubble diagram, we've simply subtracted the brightness measurements from what is expected for the low matter density, zero dark energy universe. So that's zero right here. And you can see that the points cluster way above the omega matter flat universe here, and even significantly above the, at that time, best buy value. You know, Mark Davis and my colleagues at Berkeley and elsewhere were telling us that what we will find is that omega matter is 0.3 and inflation is either wrong or has to be modified or something like that. Well, we found that the points are about 25% fainter. Hence, the supernovae and the galaxies in which they're located are about 12 or 13% farther away than you expect in a low density, zero dark energy universe. Okay? They're too far away, they're too faint. And no single point should be trusted there, but the total aggregate of points suggested in this omega lambda, omega matter plane that we are, you know, away from the lambda equals zero possibility. Now that was only, depending on how you look at it, a 2 to 3 sigma result back then. If you look at the area of all these curves, you know, most of the area is up above lambda equals zero. If you insist that omega matter is zero, then we intersect lambda of zero at only 1.6 sigma or something like that. So that's not very reassuring. But if omega matter is 0.3, then we only intersect lambda equals zero at the 3 sigma level. Now, as I'll show you, the data have gotten much, much better. But these were the data on which these two teams based their announcement. And no, we weren't sure, but we had, you know, this was the best we could do at the time. Statistically, it looked like a 2.5 to 3 sigma event or result. And we had considered, not necessarily eliminated, but we had considered the obvious systematic effects like extinction and luminosity evolution and things like that. So this suggested a non-zero cosmological constant. And there are all these headlines here. We use this term anti-gravity, you know, hesitantly, because it's not really anti-gravity, okay? And also reporters ask us, you know, whether we can attach this to cars and levitate over the Bay Area traffic jams and stuff. And is this what the astronauts used on the moon? Because clearly they had anti-gravity boots and stuff, right? Because the popular misconception that there's no gravity on the moon and whatever. Anyway, so our reaction was between, you know, amazement and horror, because amazement, this is not what we expected to find. We expected to find a decelerating universe with an omega matter, something like 0.3. Horror, because, you know, we still weren't absolutely sure that we're right. But, you know, it looked pretty good. So my postdoc at the time was a Miller Fellow at Berkeley, Adam Reese. He's now on the staff at Space Telescope Science Institute. And he was the first on our team to realize what the data were telling us. And he was in the office next door. And late 97, early 98 was the most exciting time of my career, because he'd come in every few days. to show me the results of the photometry. And I kept telling him, you know, Adam, you don't know how to do photometry. This can't be right. Go back to your office and figure out how to make the measurements correctly. And he didn't find any error. And then others on our team didn't find any errors, and they did the analysis independently. And then we started hearing rumors that the LBL team was finding a weird result, but we didn't know what the result was. And they were hearing rumors that we were finding a weird result, but they didn't know what our result was. But the only two weird results would be omega matter of 1. And that would only be sort of weird because, you know, a lot of theorists expected us to find that. Another weird result is that, well, maybe there's lambda. And so we both decided to announce at the same meeting, and that was kind of really an exciting time. And quite correctly, nearly everyone doubted us. All right? I remember this meeting at UCLA, and nearly everyone said, well, this is intriguing, but lambda has reared its ugly head many times over the past century, and it's always gone away. Well, meanwhile, the people doing large-scale structure surveys were getting really great data. The Australian 2-degree field redshift survey, followed by the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, shows this large-scale structure. And you can model the growth of the large-scale structure under different assumptions. And they pointed to omega matter 0.3. And you can measure cluster masses and stuff with gravitational lensing. And they all indicate that omega matter is 0.3. And microwave background measurements were getting better and better and better. And at the time we made our supernova announcement in 1998, the microwave background contours in the omega lambda omega matter plane were something like this. So they were big fat things, which nevertheless intersected our results somewhere here. By 2000-2001, Boomerang and Maxima and all these great things, TOCO, were beginning to really narrow down their own confidence contours in this diagram. And meanwhile, large-scale structure is giving omega matter of around 0.3. So there's this amazing concordance. And just to remind you, the microwave background measurements are essentially measuring the total energy density of the universe because they're measuring the geometry of the universe. Effectively, what is the angle subtended by an object of known physical length, the size of the first, the angular scale of the first acoustic peak in the power spectrum of the microwave background. We, on the other hand, are measuring basically at these lowish redshifts of 0.5. We are, to first approximation, measuring the difference between omega lambda and omega matter, because matter is trying to slow the universe down, lambda is trying to speed it up. The distance to which a galaxy gets at a given redshift depends on who's winning this tug of war. So we're insensitive to omega matter and omega lambda as long as the difference is about the same. And the way you close off these contours is by looking at different redshifts, and the different tracks in this plane rotate and they end up closing this thing off. But the point is that all these methods are beautifully complementary, and these guys don't rely at all on the properties of supernovae, and we couldn't care less about the microwave background. Not really, Phil, you know, but the point is our supernova results don't depend on in any way on what you guys are finding, and the people studying large-scale structure don't care about any of us, you know, and so this is all really nice. And WMAP came up last year with this nice concordance with error bars of a few hundredths. And we then started studying more supernovae, and we got comparable error bars. I'll show you that in a few minutes. So that looks all very good. But now, as a quick aside, regardless of what you think about the microwave background and large-scale structure, the supernova contours alone give us a nice estimate for the product H-naught times the age of the universe, because the contours of constant H-naught T-naught are about parallel to our confidence contours. And so we get H-naught T-naught of 0.96 plus or minus 0.04 with some probability distribution. Stick in your favorite value for the Hubble constant. Let's say it's 71. You get an age of the universe of 13.7 plus or minus 1.5 gigayears. The WMAP people claim the same number, 13.7, and their error bar is only 0.2, but you've got to treat that error bar with some skepticism because they've made some assumptions in making their error bar so small, and I'm sure you've heard talks about that. But it's amazing that we come up with the same number, and probably the error bar is somewhere between 0.2 and 1.5. So the universe is 14 billion years old. It's incredible. Okay, we then, last year, as I said, going chronologically, we combined the data on about 200 supernovae, okay, in a paper published by the HiSE team, Tanri et al. And now even the 3 sigma contours are way, way above lambda equals 0. So statistically, this is a fantastic result. Systematically, you can still question it, okay? Although we've tried to do as well as we can. You might worry a little bit that this is drifting off up to here and we're only intersecting the lambda total equals 1 line at the 2 sigma level. But for reasons I won't go into right now, because I'm short on time, most observational uncertainties and errors drive you upwards in this direction. And you'll see a plot in a little while I'll show you where we've culled our best supernovae and our most recent ones. And this thing is now drifting back towards here and is intersecting this line at 1 sigma. And we didn't throw out supernovae in order for it to do that. We threw out the ones that were genuinely poorly observed. And have bigger error bars, and that has made this ellipse come down. I'll show you those results in a minute. Our results are virtually identical to those of WMAP, 0.28, 0.72, again with uncertainties of about a few hundredths. So there's very good concordance there. If you put in large-scale structure, but ignore the microwave background, these are the ellipses that we get. Similarly, if you take large-scale structure and microwave background, you get something that looks like that as well. And all 3 together look very nice indeed. So, you know, there's this interesting observational evidence for non-zero dark energy, or perhaps even the cosmological constant. But the proverbial back-of-the-envelope calculation suggests that, you know, simple theory is very wrong, okay? You get the Planck scale to the 4th power for these fluctuations, or 10 to the 120th as the expected density versus, you know, 0.7. And that's clearly pretty wrong. You know, so maybe there's something you can do to bring the discrepancy down. And you know, but the discrepancies are still of order 10 to the 50th or 10 to the 60th. And so people have said that there's super duper symmetry, and in this institute, you know, there are people who know what they're talking about and will tell you why they expected 0. Although, from what I understand, you know, that was just sort of a qualitative expectation. There's no real theory yet that demands lambda to be 0. It's just that since it's obviously not 10 to the 50th or 10 to the 120th and we're alive and all that, the next most obvious answer is that it's 0. Although, correct me if I'm wrong, there's no real theory demanding that it be 0 yet. Is that correct, David? And there you go. Okay. But in any case, there's certainly nothing that suggests that it should be so ridiculously small like 0.7. So this is a bone in the throat, all right? So people don't like the cosmological constant. So let's consider other possibilities. And these generically go under the name of quintessence, like the Aristotelian fifth essence, earth, air, fire, and water, and the celestial essence, all right? So this can be parameterized in this way, where you have essentially one number and its derivative, and of course other derivatives as well. But let's first focus on one number, this equation of state parameter, W is P over rho C squared. So for collisionless normal matter, W is 0 because the density of this stuff just goes as 1 over the volume. All right. For photons, W is 1/3 because as the box expands, so do the photons. This is the explanation for the microwave background, for example. If you truly have a property of the vacuum, well, then it's independent of the volume. It's independent of the scale factor. So W is minus 1. So you just have a density that's a property of the vacuum. And so quintessence is something that's not negative 1. It could be a constant, or it could be a function of redshift. It could be some sort of rolling scalar fields. Again, I know which end of the telescope to look through, and at this point I'm getting a little bit beyond my level of expertise, okay? But for example, W is negative 1/3 if the dark energy is in the form of cosmic strings. So the supernovae alone already give us some constraints on W versus omega M. There's this famous banana diagram, and certainly W of negative 1 is allowed, but so is nearly everything else. But, you know, at omega matter 0.3, you know, W is already looking like it's maybe minus 1. On the other hand, you know, things can be constrained much better if you use other data as well. And if we include the information that we get from large-scale structure, then the ellipses start closing down, and this becomes not unbounded, but rather bounded. But you'll notice that there's a fair amount of area below this W of minus 1 curve. Now, W less than minus 1 is a very strange stuff. It's an energy density that grows with time, and it's repulsive, okay? And so, although right now maybe it's only the space between distant clusters of galaxies that's expanding faster and faster, in the future, as this energy density increases, well, the space between galaxies and clusters will start expanding, and they'll be ripped apart. And then the space between stars in galaxies will start expanding, and that'll get ripped apart. And then stars themselves will get ripped apart, and then planets will get ripped apart, and then humans will get ripped apart, and atoms will get ripped apart. And the press just loves this. The big rip. Now there is the big rip. And Robert Caldwell at Dartmouth, I think, maybe even coined this term. I'm not sure. But from space, a new view of doomsday. The fact that we have not yet ruled out values that are less than negative 1. And you might say they're preposterous. Such an energy density is preposterous. But we observers now have taken the view that nothing is preposterous. I mean, the original announcement we made was preposterous, right? And now it's the standard model of cosmology, lambda CDM or dark energy CDM. So this should be experimentally tested, all right? And so we have formed a team called Essence, after quintessence, or the plural of supernova is essence. Equation of state, supernovae, trace cosmic expansion. Well, this is a clever use of letters to get an acronym. You notice we use various letters in the middles of words, and we ignore certain letters at the beginnings of words. But to get NASA funding, you need a good acronym, you know. And even then, in these days, you might not get NASA funding because all we want to do now is go to the moon and Mars, right? So anyway, so our goal is to measure 200 supernovae really well in the redshift range 0.2 to 0.8. To trace in detail the expansion history of the universe. Not just, well, it's expanding faster now than it was 5 billion years ago. All right. So here's this green line, which is probably barely visible, is W of minus 1 and omega matter of 0.35. And here's a Monte Carlo simulation of what we might find if W really is minus 0.8 and omega matter is 0.35. You'll see that these numbers are somewhat less than, or they're below that line. So that's what we'd like to measure. The current uncertainties look something like this. After this five-year effort that we're into, or at the end of the second year right now, we hope to decrease the confidence contours to something like this from supernovae alone. All right. Well, actually, to get a lower bound here, you have to make some assumptions about omega matter. But anyway, either W will be negative 1 or it won't be, and that'll be interesting regardless, all right? So at the end of 2 years, excuse me, we've already gathered quite a few supernovae. The red ones are the ones we've discovered and followed up on, and the numbers are becoming comparable to the total previous set of supernovae on which the results are based. But these are being observed much more carefully than the previous ones, so we're getting better data. So we're hoping to have a nice answer in 5 years. But you could say, well, you know, all right, maybe there's something really wrong with supernovae. Despite this agreement with the microwave background and large-scale structure, maybe there's something wrong. And maybe the basic result that there's dark energy is here to stay. But maybe the use of type 1a supernovae to measure the detailed properties of dark energy is flawed because the supernovae have astrophysical pitfalls, such as anomalous extinction or evolution. For example, if the dust grains back then were bigger than they are now and more gray, that is, you know, they tend to extinguish optical light, about the same, independent of wavelength, then you wouldn't get the same kind of reddening that we see for interstellar dust in our own galaxy. So the extinction properties of high Z and low Z supernovae might not be the same. And if that's the case, we might not be measuring properties of the quintessence, we might be measuring properties of dust. And to grammatically paraphrase Shakespeare a little bit, you could say, and yet to me, what is this? quintessence or dust, you know, instead of, and yet to me, what is this quintessence of dust, all right? Anyway, evolution, maybe the type 1a supernovae used to be different and less luminous a little bit. Maybe not by such an amount to make the whole result go away, because again, people are taking the dark energy seriously now because it's not just the supernova results that point to dark energy, it's the microwave background plus large-scale structure. And most recently, there's even been some slight measurement of the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect, where the point is that a photon on its way to us, falling into a cluster of galaxies, gains energy, but then on its way out, normally it would lose the same energy that it gained in an omega matter equals one universe. But in a universe where part of the total omega is dark energy of a repulsive sort, the cluster expands a little bit during the time that the photon is flying through it, so the photon loses less energy on its way out than it gained on its way in. And you can actually see that in when correlating maps of large-scale structure with the microwave background. And there's a paper that claims to have made that detection. So, and then there are people counting galaxies as a function of redshift, and they're not quite there yet, but that's a technique that I think will give concordance as well. But you might still say that the supernovae, though they give the correct basic result, maybe they aren't good enough to measure detailed properties of the dark energy. So maybe some systematic effect like dust and evolution is affecting us, maybe even to the degree that it makes all the redshift 0.5 supernovae look too faint. Well, let's explore that possibility. If a systematic effect were making the redshift 0.5 supernovae look systematically too faint, then we would expect that astrophysical systematic effect to at least remain the same at bigger redshift and probably even grow. In other words, there was even more dust as you integrate over a longer line of sight. And the white dwarfs farther back in time were even weirder than they were at redshift 0.5. So you would expect things to get even dimmer than they were at redshift 0.5. On the other hand, if the redshift 0.5 supernovae were too dim because the universe has recently accelerated, then you would expect that if you go to higher redshifts, 1 and beyond, the supernovae will start looking brighter again relative to an empty universe, and that's because you're looking back in time to when the universe was decelerating. So at redshifts 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, 0.4, 0.5, you're measuring this curve diverging away from the empty universe. Okay, so the objects are too distant compared to the empty universe. But as you go to redshifts 0.7, 0.8, 0.9, and so on, the distances are now getting bigger more slowly with time compared to those in an empty universe. And so, relatively speaking, the supernovae should start looking brighter again. So this is the smoking gun, all right? See whether they look bright again. But they're hard to find at large redshifts because they're faint. So we need to use the Hubble Space Telescope. And we've gained some confidence in looking for supernovae and following them at these redshifts with Hubble Space Telescope. Back in 1997, when Gilliland and collaborators found a supernova that they thought was a type 1a, but without a spectrum, in a repeat observation of the Hubble Deep Field. Now, there were no planned observations following this supernova as it declined, but Adam Riess dug through the Hubble archives and found that Roger Thompson, the PI of the near-infrared camera on the Hubble Space Telescope, had an imaging campaign of just this part of the Hubble Deep Field right after the supernova went off, you know, without knowing about the supernova. And Adam dug through the archives, found the supernova in a bunch of frames of data, monitored its decline, and was able to extrapolate back to a peak brightness. He couldn't interpolate because he had no points on the rise. He could only extrapolate. So the error bar is big. Don't laugh, okay? But the error bar may be small enough at redshift 1.7 that if the object lands somewhere here, and if the error bar isn't too big, it might even already provide a hint that an astrophysical contaminant is not what's causing these supernovae to be too faint. So let's see where the point lands. Here's the accelerating part of the universe, the recent few billion years. There's the decelerating part, the first 8 or 9 billion years. This is what you'd expect from dust or evolution. And what we found from supernova 1997 FF was that the point was here, with an uncertainty that was pretty big. And the only curve or family of curves that agrees with this point, the medium redshift points, and the zero redshift points are this omega matter of around 1/3, dark energy of around 2/3 universe. Okay? You might say, well, this fits even better with a matter 1/3 and dark energy 0. Well, that's true. It falls right on it. But that's the curve that doesn't agree with these data points. And Einstein de Sitter is all off from all of them. So the only family of curves that agrees with all the data points is the one near this orange set of dashed lines. Now, one supernova, of course, is far too small a sample on which to base the conclusion that you've detected the decelerating epoch of the universe. But this one supernova gave us the confidence that we can do this project with the Hubble Space Telescope. So we wrote a proposal that piggybacked on the Great Origins, Great Observatories Origins Deep Survey. It's a survey to study galaxy evolution with Hubble and SIRTIF and Chandra and everything else. And Mauro Giavalisco and gang got about 400 orbits with HST to get deep multicolor images of galaxies in a few fields in the sky. We convinced them to take their data not in a whole bunch of consecutive Hubble orbits, but rather at several different epochs spaced by 45 days. We could then look for supernovae in their multiple epoch data, and then our own proposal could be used to get the follow-up photometry of the supernovae that are found for free in their data, thus enhancing the overall utility of this rather enormous allocation of telescope time. So here are the two main regions of the sky. There was one in the north and one in the south. They were tiled in this pattern and reobserved every 45 days. There's a supernova that went off. We found 42 or 43 supernovae altogether, 16 of which turned out to be pretty certain type 1As. Here's our first one, Aphrodite. You can see visual and infrared images of it here. A great surprise was that Grissom spectra with Hubble, a small telescope, yielded data that were better than what I can get with Keck. And that's because at such high redshifts, the visible light is shifted in the near infrared, where the night skylines of our atmosphere are horrendous, and it's very difficult to subtract them. Up there, they don't have the night skylines, and so their spectrum was better than what I get at Keck at these high redshifts. So here's just some data showing that we monitored the rise and fall of Aphrodite pretty well. Again, we can measure the peak brightness, and we can measure the rate of decline, and hence make this correction for luminosities that I talked about in the first part of my talk. All right, and we did this for 16 supernovae, four of which are shown here. VLAS at redshift 0.86, Borg at 1.37, McEnroe. You know, you have to give these things names, because when Adam calls me up and he says, Alex, you know, observe supernova number 37, I'm all, well, which one is that? You know, but if he says, observe Borg or something, then, oh, that's that one next to that fuzzy little galaxy. See, this little galaxy, I remember that's Borg, okay? So anyway, so some of these are ACS Grissom spectra. Some of them are Keck spectra. I mean, I think that one is a Keck spectrum. But anyway, we got 16 of these guys, all right? And the light curves of some are better than others, because we only had 134 orbits of TOO time. So we followed some of them with Hubble Space Telescope. Others we only followed from the ground. Others have only one data point, which is pretty useless, so we throw those away. That's why some of the data are gold, and some are silver, and some are bronze, and some are, you know, dog dew or whatever. Anyway, so we throw those out. And getting to the end now, here's our bottom line. First, the Hubble diagram. So you can't tell much, because this is not a differential Hubble diagram. But anyway, this just shows that we've populated the Hubble diagram pretty well beyond redshift 1 now. And now let's look at the omega matter, omega lambda plot. I promised you that I'd show you this. Using our latest Hubble Space Telescope distant supernovae, plus all of the best published HISI type 1A data, these are now the supernova confidence contours. There's no large-scale structure here. There's no microwave background. These are now very tight, and they intersect omega total equals 1. Okay, more interesting is this. There are two versions of the same thing, the unbend version and the bend version. Okay, so these are, again, a magnitude differences or brightness differences versus redshift. Okay, here are the dust and evolution models. Now, there are many such models, but here are fairly simple generic examples where the evolution is proportional to redshift, for example. And so you'd expect these objects to get fainter and fainter with redshift. We see them getting relatively brighter again. So this rules out most simple forms of evolution and dust. It doesn't rule out all of them. Here's a type of dust known as replenishing dust. That's this model here, this solid line, which I guess is digitized because of the pixels on the screen, on the computer. But anyway, this is a weird kind of a dust where you're assuming that dust is being produced by galaxies at exactly the rate at which the universe is expanding, and it uniformly fills space right away. You've got to make this dust uniformly fill space right away. And then you can mimic what you see in the matter 0.3, lambda 0.7 universe. But what we're doing is we're painting into a tighter and tighter corner people who are trying to explain away the results through evolution or dust. We haven't ruled out all models yet, but we've ruled out many of them. Here's the differential Hubble diagram analyzed in terms of accelerations and decelerations. Okay, so let's look at the bend diagram again. Here the data suggest an accelerating universe. If it had always been accelerating, then the points would be up here. Okay, they're not. If the universe had always been decelerating, Q naught positive, using the terminology that I grew up with in grad school, then the data would be here, and they're not. A universe which is currently accelerating but used to be decelerating looks like this. And that can be parameterized in a few simple ways. The equations themselves are pretty complex, but just using two different but similar parameterizations. One, this black line is a negative Q naught. All right, so a current acceleration, but dq dz of positive, so deceleration back in the past. That's this black line, and that fits the data pretty well. Or you could say acceleration plus jerk. Q naught right now is negative, so the universe is accelerating, but the time derivative of the acceleration, which mathematically is known as the jerk, is positive. And so again, that curve nicely fits the data. In short, what we're saying is these data are consistent with a universe that used to be decelerating and is now accelerating. So the derivative of the acceleration is non-zero, and that is known as the jerk. I didn't know that until recently, okay? So that we announced these results a few months ago, and the New York Times came out with this headline, "A Cosmic Jerk That Reversed the Universe." Now, of course, most people look at the headline and the picture and don't bother to read the article. So I got a couple of phone calls and email messages from people who know that I work closely with Adam Riess. And he says, "Hey, who's this cosmic jerk who reversed the expansion of the universe?" Hey, Adam's mother did not like this juxtaposition. So anyway, we think we've measured the cosmic jerk, okay? And then we also now have pretty good constraints on W, this equation of state parameter, and also some constraints on W prime. And you notice that our one sigma contour goes all the way down to, you know, minus 1.3 and all the way up to something like minus 0.8. But nevertheless, it's squeezing down pretty well. And, you know, it's centered on W of minus 1. And if you include constraints from large-scale structure and the microwave background, this error bar actually gives, it's only 0.1. So if you include all the astrophysical constraints that we have, W is basically minus 1 plus or minus about 0.1.
Alex, is that the same data set for which the center point was an omega lambda that was...
Okay, so I'll show you. So here you go, okay? Now, I've run out of time, and I want to leave time for questions. So let's just look at the gold supernovae. Those are our best supernovae. So with a two-parameter fit, W now and dW dz, indeed, the centroid of our contour is at W of, I don't know, minus 1.3 or something, and W prime small. But at 1 sigma, we're consistent with W of minus 1 and W prime of 0. And the spin that we put on this is that right now there is no evidence for the dark energy being anything significantly different from the cosmological constant.
But why wouldn't you say that that's the same as detecting evolution?
Well, I mean, if you truly believe that, you mean this part here, the fact that we're not landing there. Yeah, well, so there may be either measurement problems or some slight evolution that's causing our thing to be up here. But our point is that right now we see no obvious spectral or other evolution, and this is consistent to within one sigma. Right? It's always a question, how do you interpret your results, right? What spin do you put on them? Mike Turner saw this plot and he goes, whoa, you've detected a W prime, right? And I said, well, and Adam said, not really. I mean, we're consistent with W prime of zero. And W of minus one and W prime of zero is kind of like a great attractor, right? It's kind of like omega total of one. You may not like the cosmological constant, but there's zillions of models that could make W and W prime be just about anything you want. And there's sort of one cosmological constant, even if we don't understand it. It's the null hypothesis, exactly. So here we are consistent with the null hypothesis, okay? And so that's our spin, all right? But what we would like to do is measure many more of these, and here's where I'll end. You know, these are interesting questions. We've set some initial constraints in this paper that's now in AstroPH. Yeah, this spin, I mean, right, so you can interpret it as evolution, as W prime being not zero. What we said was that if there is going to be a big rip, it's not going to happen anytime soon because there's no evidence that W prime is big right now, and it's certainly consistent with zero. So I wouldn't worry about the big rip. I'm sorry, the W is close to negative one, so it's not like minus 1.3 or something, especially if you go to this diagram here where you do it only as a function of W, not W prime and W naught. Anyway, so our point was is that there might be a big rip and all that, but certainly our data right now are consistent with no big rip and a cosmological constant. So we'd like to get more constraints on this W naught versus W prime plane, and I'm happy to say that we just had a Cycle 13 Hubble proposal approved for 270 orbits. That's twice as many as we had last time when we got six high redshift supernovae. So we hope to get a dozen high redshift supernovae to populate the high redshift Hubble diagram even more. And this was a two-year proposal for like 600 orbits. Our aim was to quadruple the sample, and we hope that in cycle 14 they will give us, you know, even more time. Because we're not basing our results on very many data points out there. They're more suggestive than they were back when we were basing our results only on supernova 1997 FF. But still, to this day, we only have six supernovae out there at high redshifts, and we'd like more. So the present and the future, well, at low redshifts, we're going to continue to study the type 1a supernovae in detail to find out ways to make them even better distance indicators. Those of you who were perceptive noticed that some of the data points, even in my low redshift Hubble diagram, were considerably off the line, and that could be that those are weird supernovae that are teaching us that there are second parameters to this light curve luminosity thing, and we have collaborators in Arizona and Las Campanas who are helping us study these nearby guys. At medium redshifts, there's our ESSENCE project, and the competing, much bigger CFHT legacy survey. They want to measure 2,000 supernovae at around redshift 0.5, and we're only really equipped to measure 200 of them. But they're putting vast resources into this project, and I salute them, but on the other hand, I want to beat them too. And so they're definitely giving us a run for our money. And the Las Campanas people are getting into the game as well. And then finally, we'd like to go to the highest redshifts to probe this era of deceleration better and better, to get more constraints on W and W prime. And we will do this in the next year or two, we hope, with the existing facilities. We hope that there will be a fourth servicing mission for Hubble, and I urge you to write your senators and members of Congress about that issue, to re-examine Sean O'Keefe's hasty behind closed doors decision. The whole status of, you know, Beyond Einstein and the Joint Dark Energy Mission is now on hold because we're all going to go to Mars and stuff. But, you know, there's SNAP, which is a very worthwhile thing, and there's now Destiny, which is another way of doing it. So I think we've got an exciting future ahead of us, which, however, is made uncertain by NASA's recent decisions. And I personally am quite worried about the direction into which space astrophysics will go in the next few years, unless all of us astronomers and physicists and, you know, excite the general public into an uprising to urge the administration to keep on funding space science other than just, you know, the moon and Mars. Thank you very much. Sorry for going on a bit long, but, you know.
So, if I look at your centroids versus all the other data's centroids, that's where you see science correlation.
That's correct. That's right. If our centroids are significantly off, and I don't think I have the diagram that. No, I don't have the. Well, if you go back and you add some of the large scale structure stuff, what it does is it's still really quite broad. It doesn't really do that much yet to tighten things. And similarly, the microwave background, I've forgotten what it does to these contours, but they're all broadly consistent right now. And the microwave background and large scale structure alone do not really yet set any meaningful constraint on W prime. I think it's the supernovae again that are, I think, proudly leading the way to testing, you know, new things, right? And maybe I'm sure the microwave background people will have better data with the release of the second year of the WMAP results coming, and with Planck, you know, on the horizon and all that. They will, I'm sure, be able to get better constraints with some assumptions, but again, the supernovae, I think, are leading the way. So, yeah.
Other questions?
No. Yeah, Crystal. Hi.
Are the decline rates of the light curves of the 1As roughly evenly distributed between the slow decliners?
Yeah. So at low redshifts, about 60% or 70% of the supernovae are within what's called sort of the normal bunch. And then about 15 to 20% are in the subluminous and a comparable number in the overluminous. At high redshifts, we don't find the seriously underluminous ones, but that's a well-understood selection bias. We just don't see them. They're too faint. Yeah. So at high redshifts, we don't see this low luminosity tail, but we think it's probably there.
And what's the current thinking about physically underlying?
Right. So So this is both understood and not understood. What the luminosity light curve shape correlation is thought to be due to is fundamentally a difference in the amount of nickel produced by the supernova. So the luminous supernovae produce more nickel. They decay to cobalt and iron, and that's what drives the optical light curve of a supernova. A little realized fact is that the initial explosion energy is entirely used up in adiabatic expansion, making this little Earth-sized thing big enough to radiate efficiently. So a 1A glows because of the nickel that it produced. The luminous ones produce more nickel. They also heat the ejecta more, more nickel, more heating, and that actually makes the opacities higher, trapping the radiation longer and leading to a broader light curve. Now, what makes more nickel in some 1As than in others? That's a tweaking parameter in the explosion models. There's no physical basis right now. So that's not understood. Yeah. So, you know.
Yeah, further questions? Let's thank the speaker.
Good. Thank you. Thanks very much, David. Yeah.